This is Judith Lay welcoming you to Manx Radio and to the podcast of this week's edition of At Your Service. Manx Radio. On today's programme, we're joined by Brendan O'Friel as he reflects on the part his Christian faith played in supporting and guiding him through possibly one of the most difficult jobs that anyone could choose to do. And this is the day that's often called the birthday of the Christian Church, Pentecost Sunday. After Jesus rose from the dead, he appeared many times to his disciples, repeating his message of love, hope, and everlasting life, the message he wanted them to go out and share in the world. Then, as Jesus left them and went back to heaven, he said he would send them a helper. That helper was the Holy Spirit, the power that came down on the nervous, frightened apostles on the first Pentecost Sunday and turned them into fearless preachers who, against all opposition, went out teaching, healing, and caring for people, just as Jesus had told them to do. It was the start of a ministry that we're all called to share in to this very day. But what might it have been like to actually be there? Reverend Alex Brown knows.
Holy Spirit, living breath of God, breathe your life into my weary soul.
Tell you about it because I was there. I mean, there were literally thousands of us there because it was Pentecost and we'd come to Jerusalem to worship. But what I mean is I was one of the ones who saw it all and heard it all. I mean, you couldn't come into Jerusalem that year and not hear about Jesus. He was on everyone's lips. The things he'd been doing, the things he'd been saying, and the way that he'd stood up to the corrupt leaders, it really was like he could be the one we'd all been waiting for, you know? The one like King David, people had said, or the one like Moses, others had said. Maybe the Son of Man that we'd read about in Daniel. But then they'd betrayed him and they'd crucified and killed him. But it wasn't the end of the story. Whispers had spread, rumors and suggestions had been spreading like wildfire that the inner disciple group had seen Jesus again. And so had others, 500 others, maybe more. And if we wanted to hear about it, it was easy because all the followers met every day in the temple courts, the only place in the temple where everyone was welcome. And they talked about him to anyone who asked. When we asked them what was next, they simply said they didn't know. God had said to them, wait in Jerusalem. So here they were, waiting. So that morning I went to worship in the temple, me and thousands of others. And the believers of Jesus were gathered there too. And suddenly there was this sound like a violent wind. And as we looked to where the sound seemed to be coming from, we could see these flames of fire that were coming down from heaven and they stayed on the heads of the believers and they burnt there, like it must have been for Moses when he saw the burning bush or for Solomon when they dedicated the temple in the first place. Whatever was happening, God wanted there to be no mistake. This was no human event. Then, telling everyone what God had been doing, the believers started to speak, but they weren't just speaking in their own languages of Aramaic and Hebrew and Greek. They were speaking in everyone's languages. So many languages, languages that we knew. They couldn't have been fluent in those. It was staggering. Finally, Peter stood up, because people are shouting all over, asking what this means. And everyone hushed. I mean, you could have heard a pin drop. And Peter started explaining to us, this was the start and the end of something both ancient and new, all at the same time. This is Joel's prophecy from hundreds of years before. The final time when God is going to give his spirit to everyone. If you're a son or a daughter, you can speak God's words. If you're a young person, you can have visions from God. And not just the rich or influential, even servants like me, regardless of gender, can hear God's voice. Just before this day, Joel had said, there'll be signs and miracles, there'd be blood and there'd be fire. And on that cross, the sun had gone dark. But now, here was that day. And so everyone who calls on God's name can be saved. Believe me, I was there. We live in these final days, the time of Jesus' resurrection, the final time itself. And if we call on God, he'll fill us with his spirit. This beautiful, powerful truth is here for the world to see. Every language, every tribe, every people, rich or poor, male or female. So have courage, have faith, believe me, and experience this reality of God for yourself. I was there. I was there.
Come on.
Manx-born Brendan O'Friel has spent a lifetime working in the prison service, much of it as a governor, most notably at Strangeways in Manchester during the notorious riots of 1990. Now in retirement in Port St Mary, Brendan has just published a book. Entitled Prison Governor's Journal, it has already been acclaimed as essential reading for anyone considering joining the prison service, as it gives insights into the challenges of his work in 7 penal institutions and poses a number of questions that really must be considered if we truly want to reform a penal system currently in crisis. But this morning, Brendan joins us to reflect on his working life from a faith perspective, how his Catholic upbringing guided a very difficult career. And the hymn that you'll hear is a very familiar tune with brand new words and is being well received because it directly addresses the need for change, compassion and a fresh understanding in our modern world, with the recurring line to end each verse, transform, revive and heal society. Let's join Brendan now as he recalls those early days when his schooling took him off the island.
I had 9 years away at Stonyhurst, where the Jesuit fathers undoubtedly had a considerable influence on me. I didn't necessarily fully understand that at the time, but looking back, I can see areas where they had a lot of influence. And from Stonyhurst, I went to Liverpool University and read law, and it was from Liverpool that I decided to go into the prison service. The reason I went into the prison service was fairly straightforward. I spent the first year doing law and then decided I'm not sure that I want to be either a barrister or a solicitor, so reverted to thing I'd always had an interest in, which was teaching. When I looked around at opportunities for teaching during university holidays, the places that stood out were the Home Office approved schools. And I went round several Home Office approved schools, Catholic Home Office approved schools generally, although not all of them. And to be honest, I was completely shocked by what I saw. And I thought, I'm sure I can do better than this. In the way one does when you're young and sort of full of enthusiasm and wanting to put the world right. And then in my last year at university, I saw the advertisement for the prison service, which was trying to recruit some assistant governors, and I applied and I was fortunate and was appointed. Well, when the prison service put us through this six-month training course. They then dispersed us to various young offenders and, in some cases, adult establishments around the country. I was posted to Loudoun Grange, which was the original open borstal in Nottingham. And the reason I later learnt from the director who posted me was that they wanted a Catholic there because the governor and the local chaplain had fallen out big time. It was quite a funny story, really. Chaplain had demanded that he be fetched, that he be driven to celebrate Mass at the borstal. The governor was short of vehicles and people and sent round the milk lorry, and the parish priest was not amused, and I think all communication had dropped. So I spent my first 6 months at Loudoun Grange getting a reasonable sort of service going. We managed to get the curate to come and say the masses, who was a much younger man, and although he wasn't particularly talented with the borstal boys, he was a great deal better than the parish priest, who was a bit traditional. So the fact that I was a Catholic was sort of almost at the forefront of my mind when I was first appointed at Loudoun. And this was, it was only a small part of a whole raft of duties I had. But nonetheless, I was very much in the lead with this to try and sort out a difficulty between the governor and the chaplain. In those days, the 1960s, not only did worship take place, but it was compulsory. So literally everybody had to attend. It was only round about 1970s when it became voluntary. And it was part of the routine. The routine that was set up when the prisons were nationalised in the 1880s, involved prisoners all doing the same thing at the same time. And there was a high degree of compulsion about what they did. Voluntarism was something that I saw come in my time. It was much better when we got it down on a voluntary basis. It was all young offenders I was dealing with during the years when it was compulsory. But a lot of the young offenders just didn't want to be there. And although we tried all sorts of manoeuvres to try and make it more acceptable for them, for example, my third posting at Onley, which is near Rugby, I managed to arrange that the boys just had to come in for the first part of the Mass, and after the sermon, those that wanted could leave. So we just had those who believed, if you like, really, for the second part of the Mass. And that didn't work badly. But, I mean, the whole idea of compelling people to go to church, nowadays, most people wouldn't believe that it used to happen. When we were appointed as assistant governors, we had a six-month training course. And I've described that six-month training course in a bit of detail because it's enabled me to talk about what the prison system was like, what prisoners were like, what staff were like. And one of the factors that I lay great stress on is the way many prisoners have got significant mental health problems, how a high proportion of them have been in care, how quite a number of them have been excluded from school. You rapidly build up a picture of people who are generally deprived. If you want to make value judgment, you can sometimes say it's partly their fault because of their behaviour. But nonetheless, the individuals that are in front of us in prison very often are people who have not got the advantages and the education and the upbringings that the vast majority of people in the country have. That then takes you back to what is your moral and philosophical approach. If you believe in God, as I do, and you believe that God created everybody, then everybody has got great worth in God's eyes. We have to treat people in the light of the fact that they are each individual worth a great deal in God's eyes. And that can be very challenging because, believe me, there are some very difficult individuals in the prison population who will challenge and challenge and challenge again and behave very, very badly. Not necessarily always to oneself, but perhaps to other prisoners or to staff. So it's a constant challenge coming at you. I think we've got to be positive about all this. What you've got to see, I think, when you're dealing with offenders is the potential. And because they've had, on the whole, a pretty poor life experience for whatever reason, if during their time in prison it's possible to improve them, to offer them opportunities for improvement in a whole variety of ways, from the very basic, I mean, quite a high proportion of prisoners have very poor literacy and numeracy. If we can build that up, then they will learn how to communicate better. They'll be able to cope with the complexities of modern life a little better. And all those things are perfectly achievable. And then we can go beyond that and say, if they're going to earn a living, they need certain skills and disciplines. And those, again, are things that a prison with the right facilities can provide. I've always said with prisoners, you are not going to either cure or change or alter all of them, but you can change and develop and improve a significant number. And it's that approach that makes all the difference. We need to put the resources in so that as many prisoners as possible come out of prison with skills, improved attitude, an ability to start to work their own lives on their own and with their family and friends' support, so that they're never again going to trouble the criminal justice system, that they start to make a contribution to the community.
We seek your kingdom throughout every sphere.
Probably one of the most testing periods in Brendan O'Friel's career was his time at Strangeways Prison in Manchester, where he was governor before and during the notorious riots of April 1990.
In 1986, when I went to Strangeways, it was in a pretty poor state. It lacked investment, it was stuck in a rut, there were all sorts of things wrong with it. And this despite the fact that 6 years earlier, we'd had the BBC television programmes, which has exposed the awful conditions for prisoners, the very difficult working conditions for staff, and the total lack of resources. Now, in the 3 years leading up to the riot, we'd been able to transform a lot of the life for prisoners in strange ways by hugely improving the regime. This was because of a big change to staff conditions of service called Fresh Start, and it was this that led us to moving from 40 prisoners being in the workshops during the day to 400 being in a day. I mean, enormous increase. But when they went back to their cells, they were still in overcrowded cells, slopping out, very poor conditions. And, you know, the prison had lacked the investment that it so urgently needed. So in a sense, the prisoners had a point, but no more than a point. What I found so angry about the riot was that they were destroying the progress that we'd made. And in a sense, it was the prisoners who suffered most, although I wouldn't want to underestimate the extent to which it affected staff either. But it was a complete disaster. And as a result of the riot, many Manchester prisoners were dispersed all over the country. They lost their visits. They were probably in poorer conditions. It was awful. So when I saw the riot start, when I went in and we got it under some sort of proper management control, even though it went on for 25 days, I wasn't able to hold a press conference earlier on, which is a great pity because a lot of silly stories got around, like there were 10 dead bodies in Strangeways, which was rubbish. But when I was able to talk to the press, I wanted to make the point that I was very angry about what had gone on. And I used this expression, an explosion of evil. That's what it was. And I still stand by that. I think it was. And when you saw the way in which they treated vulnerable prisoners, some of the rioters, the fact that they beat people up very badly, one prisoner died probably as a result of that, it was appalling. And I was going to put on the record what I thought about that, and I did. So that gives you some idea of my immediate reaction to the riot. the second week, for example, we had the most horrendous stories about they were going to try and burn the whole place to the ground. I can remember ringing up the local Catholic bishop and asking if we can have special prayers for a peaceful outcome without deaths and the rest of it. So I was very conscious of that dimension of what we were doing. But you must understand that the 25 days of the riot was, A, you were working extraordinarily hard. You were having to take, particularly in the first few days, very difficult decisions at very short notice to try and protect life, to keep injuries to a minimum, and if possible, to get back in control. That was extraordinarily difficult. Another strand of my career was working with the Prison Governors Association and the organisation that preceded it, if you like, the Governors Trade Union. It was heading towards being a professional association, but it actually had both elements in it. And in that, I was privy to people who were treated very unfairly by politicians or people in the prison service, and we had to defend them. I had that very dramatic experience of the Director General trying to blame me for taking a decision I hadn't taken during the Strange Ways riot. But we also had a number of occasions when governors had had some sort of disaster. And from the politician's point of view, it was very handy to put the blame on the governor. Now, it may well be that part of the blame should have gone on the governor, but it's very rare that it should be all on the governor. And I was involved in trying to defend people who had been very unfairly treated. So that's another element of all this. Comes back to my underlying principles that you treat people fairly, whether they're prisoners, staff. It's a challenge because inevitably, when you go into the nitty-gritty of any situation, there are things that have gone wrong. I can remember in the earlier part of the riot, after a few days when things were starting to settle down, I remember remarking breezily to one of my colleagues, I didn't think we'd had any warning of the riot coming. In fact, when we did the investigations afterwards, sure enough, bits and pieces came out where if we'd been a bit cleverer, we might have taken more precautions. Whether we'd have stopped the riot, I'm very dubious, but there's no doubt about it, we could have done more.
Forgive us, Lord, when we have not engaged,
failing to scribe your heart on history's page.
Although my guest today, Brendan O'Friel, is in retirement now, he still cares passionately about the future of the prison service.
If you look back to the 20s and 30s, where they had these 10,000 prisoners, daily average population, and we're now in 2020, we've got 80,000 plus. All I would say to people is we should ask ourselves, why are we locking up this number? What good is it doing? And one of the things that drove me to complete the book was the pandemic, because I felt that there's a real opportunity at the moment for change. You see, almost everybody across the world has had to experience a loss of freedom. We've all not been able to mix with relatives. We've had to stay in our houses. We've not been able to travel here in the Isle of Man. And it's been painful. People have suddenly realised that losing freedom is not a joke. Now, it's not a joke either for prisoners, and it's been particularly not a joke, I think, during the pandemic. So I'm rather hoping that one of the things that will happen as a result of our experiences, people will reflect on them and will understand that while we've got to continue to use imprisonment in appropriate cases, and in some cases for very long periods of time, but the extent to which we've fallen into the habit of using imprisonment has got to be radically looked at and reduced. That's the only way we're really going to be able to make progress towards moving prisons towards reform. And if reform has even a limited effect, that's going to make the public safe. And anything that makes the public safer than they are at the moment is, I think, something that should get very wide support. The link between crime and deprivation is not always fully understood. The principle of trying to help the deprived communities improve, I think that's critical. One of the, I suppose, key things that's made me complete the book was when I saw Pope Francis in Easter 2020, Holy Week actually, 2020, on his own, walking across St. Peter's Square in the rain, this lonely-looking old man. And yet Pope Francis has challenged us all. He's had the energy, the foresight to challenge us all to say, look, when all this is over, or as it gets better, we can't go back to what we were doing previously. We've got to make the world a better place. And it was that challenge, really, and I thought, well, that's it. I've got to finish that book.
And finished it is. Prison Governor's Journal by Brendan O'Friel is available from the Lexicon Bookshop in Douglas, from Church's Bookshop, both of whom offer online buying if that's more convenient for you, and you'll also find the book wherever else Manx publications are on sale on the island. It's packed with illustrations and is an illuminating insight into life and work in the penal system. And now we finish with a look at our notice board. And first, a reminder that Praying the Keels Week started yesterday with a variety of walks, talks and worship celebrating our Manx early Christian heritage. Their website, prayingthekeels.org, or their Facebook page are good ways to see what's on offer each day during the coming week. Looking now to this afternoon, and I'll be in Ballykilferrick Chapel for an animal blessing service starting at 3 o'clock, where there'll be a warm welcome for all creatures, great and small. The Mariners' Choir are at the Howe Chapel tonight at 6:30, when the Archdeacon, the Venerable Andy Brown, will preach, and as usual there'll be supper and community hymn singing afterwards. The annual general meeting for the Friends of Robert Owen House will be held in St Andrew's United Reformed Church Hall on Glen Crutchery Road here in Douglas this coming Wednesday morning. That's the 26th at 11 a.m. If you need any more information in advance of the meeting, contact Ruth Denning on 622 129. Looking ahead to next Sunday, the 30th, Trinity Methodist Church at Rosemount here in Douglas have morning worship led by Reverend Richard Hall. Baldrine Methodist Chapel invite you to their animal blessing service on Sunday the 30th at 11 a.m. It'll be in Baldrine Chapel Hall with Mr. Bert Quayle, and there'll be a warm welcome for everyone and their pets with refreshments afterwards. And that's all that we have time for today. Just a little reminder that this programme is available as a podcast from 7 a.m. each Sunday morning. It's easy to access it via our website, manxradio.com, but you'll also find it on all the main podcast platforms too. News for the notice board and requests for your favourite hymns to be included in future programmes can all be sent to me via email, judithleigh@manxradio.com, or by post if you prefer. My address is Manx Radio, P.O. Box 1368, Douglas IM 991SW. I'll be back tonight at 9 with Sundown, easy listening music to round off your weekend. But for now, this is Judith saying thank you for listening, and I wish you and those you love a blessed, safe and peaceful week. And a very good morning. Manx Radio.